Hello and welcome to The Europeans, a podcast that tries to make sense of this complicated continent that we call home. I'm Dominic Kramer, I'm in Amsterdam, and I'm speaking to Katie Lee in Paris. Hi, Katie.
Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm fine. Well, I'm fine, but also very busy.
Oh, yeah?
A bit too busy, yeah. And I've started doing a weird thing in the night.
Okay.
Where a few nights in a row, I've woken up and opened the curtains at 2 a.m. in the morning and shouted, "Morning!" at my husband.
What? Are you okay?
Half in sleep. I don't know, but I think I'm just like so busy that my brain is like, okay, time to get working again.
I'm a little worried about you. Although, aren't you just returning to your roots here? Because humans used to sleep in kind of two shifts, didn't we?
It's true.
And quite often just do stuff in the middle of the night. So maybe you should be getting up if that's what your body's telling you to do and just, you know, getting some admin done.
Maybe I should just work on the podcast a bit more in the middle of the night. I think that is not the answer.
Doesn't sound healthy.
How are you?
I'm good. I took my little boy this weekend down to the south of Paris, which is where the main Chinatown is, for the end of the Lunar New Year celebrations. Happy Year of the Snake, everyone.
Ooh.
So my son got to connect with his Asian heritage by watching the lion dancing for the first time in his life, which was very cute. And I think I want to sign him up to join one of these lion dancing troops as quickly as possible, because I hadn't really thought about it much before. But lion dancing is basically an extortion racket, because during the Lunar New Year celebrations, your restaurant or business has to pay for the lions to come and dance on the street in front of your shop and, like, you know, bring luck to the business. And we were watching the lions dance outside this restaurant for absolutely ages because they hadn't paid up. The lions were, like, basically harassing this restaurant for the cash that they were owed. So I feel like this could be a good way for my kid to earn some cash and, you know, pay for the roof that I put over his head.
I think it's a great idea, but I'm not sure I agree with your analysis that that means it's extortion. It sounds to me like they are performers that should be paid.
They're just freelancers who are chasing their invoices.
Yeah, exactly.
We've been there. Anyway, I don't know. My son is 16 months old, so I don't think he'd make a very tall or impressive lion just yet.
Tiny little lion.
But he can get training.
I love it.
But enough about lion dancing and your increasingly unusual nighttime habits. What are we talking about on the show this week?
Yeah, well, the nighttime habits are perhaps an organic segue into what we're talking about today, because we're going to be discussing the wonder of dark night skies. Maybe that's why I was opening the curtains, to check out the beauty of darkness.
Except that you were shouting, "Morning!"
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to be looking at how all this artificial light we're putting into the world as humans is affecting our bodily systems and the entire natural world. Later on in the show, we'll be joined by the writer Anna Levin, who has done a lot of writing on artificial light and what it is doing to our planet. That's coming up later on in the show, but first, it's time for Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Who has had a good week, Dominic?
It's been a good week for the Baltic states after they finally disconnected their electricity grid from the Russian network over the weekend, cutting ties with Putin or electricity wires. Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania are now connected to the European Union's electricity grid.
Woohoo!
Are you excited, Katie?
So excited.
Good.
I mean, I guess I might be a bit excited if I actually knew what an electricity grid is, I have to confess. It's one of those things that people say as if it's obvious, but I'm not sure it is. Like, what is it really?
I imagine you're not the only person who doesn't really know what an electricity grid is. So, yeah, I'll tell you. It's basically the backbone of the electricity system. An electricity grid is a large network of the power plants, transmission lines, and distribution centers that ensure that electricity gets sent to the places it needs to be used.
Okay, so it's like the whole system.
Exactly, yeah. It's the big word for how everything works.
Thank you.
And up until last weekend, Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania were part of the so-called BRELL power grid, which is a power grid that is run rather uncomfortably for the Baltic states from Moscow.
Mm.
BRELL stands for the five countries that were up until this weekend on that grid. So Belarus, Russia, Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania.
It's kind of strange that this is happening so late in the day, because I thought EU countries hadn't been buying any electricity from Russia since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine back in 2022.
Yes, it's true. No EU countries have been buying electricity from Russia, although, of course, we know there is still some gas being bought from Russia, but that's a different thing. The Baltic states on this network also haven't been buying electricity from Russia or Belarus since May 2022, but they had been using this Soviet-era electricity grid, which meant they were synchronized with Russia, even though they weren't actually buying any electricity from them. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Good.
And presumably that must have been quite risky, like having your whole electricity system hooked up to Russia's.
Yeah, I mean, Russia is a hostile nation for these Baltic states now. And we know that Russia is absolutely not afraid of using the limitation of energy as a geopolitical tool in its hybrid warfare toolbox. From what I read, in theory, Russia could have done some damage to the electricity supply in the Baltic states if it had wanted to, because the electrical grid was synchronized with a Russian-controlled thing called the Integrated Power System.
Okay.
Stay with me. In normal words, that means that dispatch centers in Moscow were in charge of maintaining electric frequency stability.
Mm-hmm.
And if Russia had decided... Sorry, yeah, I realize it's kind of technical language. But basically, if Russia had decided to mess around with that, it could have created instability or even blackouts on the grid.
Okay.
So this move away from the Russian grid was about removing that vulnerability. But it was more than that. It was also about modernizing the electricity grid in the Baltic states, because the Soviet-era Braille grid is apparently quite outdated and prone to technical problems, which the Baltic states had not much control over. So that's all why this past weekend, these three countries were really celebrating integrating further with their fellow EU neighbors, joining the EU's common electricity market and opening up more opportunities for a broader mix of electricity sources.
Okay, seems like this is the right move all round. Is there any downside to disconnecting from the Russian electricity grid and connecting to the European one?
Well, maybe this isn't like an immediate downside, but it's a concern, and that is that Russia could decide to retaliate in some way, try to get revenge for these countries leaving Braille. There have been all these cases of suspected Russian sabotage lately in the Baltic Sea over the past year and a half. 11 cables have been cut in the Baltic Sea. And there is concern that Russia could ramp up this cable cutting and or retaliate with cyber attacks on the grid. The EU and the Baltic states say that they are well prepared for any potential retaliation, but these ongoing attempts to interfere with the EU's energy supply are a really serious concern for Europe. And yeah, there have been calls from clever analysts like Shimon Kardash at the European Council on Foreign Relations.
Our former guest.
Indeed, to increase investment in Baltic energy infrastructure to strengthen the resilience of Baltic energy security. I guess the other downside, if it can be seen as a downside, was that this was an incredibly expensive project, as you might imagine.
Yeah, how much does it cost to like unplug all of the wires and like connect the new ones?
It's thought to have cost about 1.6 billion euros.
Wowza.
But the good news is there's no indication that these countries joining the EU's grid will see any rise in their price of electricity. If anything, there's actually a hope that the electricity prices will lower towards the end of this year in those countries as some new renewables come online. I think it's genuinely good news, although one other maybe messy thing that happened over the past few weeks as the Baltic states were trying to decouple from Russia has been this campaign of disinformation, presumably organized by Russia, which included leaflets in Russian being spread around apartment blocks in some of these areas, suggesting that people were going to lose access to their electricity and that all prices were going to rise. But when it came to it, the transition went really smoothly over the weekend. There was no problem with continuity of electricity. And actually, there was this weird 24 hours after the three countries disconnected from Russia and before they connected to the EU system. So for 24 hours, Lithuania, Latvia and Estonia were a little energy island, something that will probably never happen again.
A mini grid. That is very exciting.
Do you want to know a random exciting fact about the electricity grid of the European Union?
Sure, I do, always.
It is the second largest electricity grid in the world.
Oh, after?
After, yeah, where would you think the biggest is?
China?
Yes, it is. And it includes now all of the European Union countries and also some non-EU countries, Moldova, Ukraine and Turkey. Are you bored by my facts about the European Union's electricity grid?
No, I'm learning many things.
Good.
My one question is, why didn't this happen sooner? I mean, we have been in this extremely hostile relationship with Russia for a good long while now. It seems kind of weird that it took so long to cut the wires and connect the new ones.
Yeah, well, it's been a long time coming. The agreement for the three Baltic states to join the EU's grid was approved back in 2007.
Oh, so like way before the invasion then.
Exactly, yeah. So they've been wanting this to happen for a long time, but it's a huge project. And it did get accelerated in 2022 after the full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And in the end, it actually finished 10 months ahead of schedule.
Something in Europe happening ahead of schedule?
Indeed, it's a miracle.
Amazing.
The EU and the leaders of the Baltic states really wanted to make something of this momentous occasion, marking it as a blow for Russia and a sign of EU solidarity with Ukraine and with each other. So they actually organized this really flashy event in Vilnius last weekend to celebrate what they called Baltic Energy Independence Day.
Whoop, whoop.
And I'm sending you a clip now, Katie. Can you click on this link and just watch the beginning of this video?
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow, lasers. Oh my God. What's happening? I feel like I'm at a Daft Punk concert.
It's really quite impressive, isn't it? The light design is phenomenal.
They seem to have organised a full-on rave, but all of the attendees are like really boring looking politicians.
It's really boring politicians, but watching something that looks a bit like the Eurovision Song Contest set in a Star Wars movie, but for lovers of energy security. Honestly, I kind of love that they organised this event, and I was quite surprised. I don't see the EU doing things like this very often, and I wondered whether this is what we need.
For every piece of boring legislation that we pass, there should be a laser show.
Totally agreed. I'm kind of tempted to do like a whole reaction video with you where we go through that, because there are some amazing, there's a bit where like an electric guitarist plays Ode to Joy very dramatically with huge speakers. And there's also a moment where the leaders of the countries all stand together with these lights that turn on, and it's very like Star Wars and lightsabery. But there were also some boring speeches from politicians, which brought the mood down a bit, honestly. But they are saying encouraging nice things about integration. And Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, announced some plans to try and strengthen Europe's energy security. But yeah, for this week, I want to give good week to the Baltic states, who were occupied by Soviet forces until the 90s. And now finally managed to cut some of those final literal cords to Russia. Ursula von der Leyen said, "This is freedom, freedom from threats, freedom from blackmail."
Good job, Baltic friends.
Who's had a bad week?
I'm going to give my bad week to jumbo Chinese websites that sell a lot of cheap stuff. You've probably heard of some of these websites. They've basically become household names in Europe in recent years. AliExpress, for example.
Yeah. I have heard of it, but I try not to use it.
Yeah, I was going to ask, have you ever bought anything from AliExpress or
Temu?
Or Temu, I don't know how you say it.
No, I haven't actually, because I just think it's not right to order stuff and get it shipped across the world. Yeah, it just feels like very bad for the environment.
Well, you're a better person than me, because I did place one regrettable order to one of these websites, Shein, the fast fashion website, many years ago. I think I bought a swimsuit or something. Anyway, it was back when this website was a lot less well known, but I clearly didn't ask myself enough questions about how this swimming costume could possibly be this cheap. And I'm very sorry, because in the years since then, Shein has racked up an impressive collection of criticisms about how it operates. Horrific working conditions in its factories, where people sometimes work illegal 75-hour weeks. Shamelessly stealing the ideas of independent designers and knocking out really cheap copies of the same thing. And then, of course, as you've already mentioned, Dominic, there is the huge environmental cost of this kind of fast fashion, encouraging people to buy loads and loads of cheap, low quality, very, very unbiodegradable clothes and throw them into landfills when they inevitably start falling apart. Mm-hmm. So that's Shein. To give you another example that we've just flagged up, Temu. It's kind of like a Chinese Amazon. You've probably seen it come up in search results, even if you've never been on the website. They sell everything from furniture to electronics. Again, at incredibly low prices. Like you could buy a smartwatch on Temu for €6. And again, there have been many red flags raised, including questions about whether the products that you buy there have potentially been produced using Uyghur slave labor. Mm. But despite all of the controversies, these Chinese websites have very much become a fixture of online shopping in Europe because they are so damn cheap. Why have these websites had a bad week? Well, Shein have had a particularly bad week because they have been singled out among these websites and are now being targeted by an EU investigation into their consumer practices. Temu was already under investigation, but it's also been a bad week for the Chinese e-commerce giants more generally. And I'll tell you why. If you were a worse person, Dominic, and you order things from Shein or Temu on the regular, you would know that if you do order from one of these websites, very often your item will come in a package that arrives in the post directly from China.
As opposed to like via a distribution center in Europe or something.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a really different kind of business model. And it is a part of why products from these websites are so cheap. Because basically, there is this loophole in the EU's customs regulations that means that if the value of a parcel is under 150 euros, you don't have to pay customs on it. And Chinese websites like Shein and Temu have factored this into their business model, right? So instead of having these Amazon-type distribution systems where you have like warehouses dotted all over Europe, and then when someone places an order, the item gets shipped from the nearest warehouse, Temu will ship your individual item in an individual package straight from China. So it's a neat way for them to avoid paying a bunch of tax as a company. Because imagine that they imported like a whole container load of smartwatches to Europe and then kept them in a warehouse here. They would have to pay customs duties on the shipment of smartwatches, right? Mm-hmm. So even though doing the deliveries directly from China makes things slower and it's a less agile kind of business model than the Amazon one, it is worth it for them because it helps keep their prices super, super low. Having said that, you know, it's hardly the Chinese company's fault that the EU has this policy. Like, you can't really blame them for taking advantage of the fact that the EU itself has said they can't be bothered to inspect every little parcel and make sure that the customs fees are paid on them. Good for Temu, I hear you cry.
I didn't cry that.
The problem is that the fact that all of these little packages are shipped in individually from China to Europe, that means that a huge amount of counterfeit products are entering the EU this way. I'll give you an example. A little while back, my husband was trying to buy some guitar strings online. And there is one particularly iconic brand of guitar strings that a lot of guitarists know and love. So he was trying to buy some new strings. And he saw that the strings were way cheaper on AliExpress than they were anywhere else. And he thought, oh, okay, they do seem crazy cheap, but maybe they're coming directly from the factory that makes them. That is the case for a lot of AliExpress stuff. So he bought them. And when they turned up, the packet looked almost identical to the well-known brand. But the font was a bit weird. And they were fake. They were functioning guitar strings. But actually, when he went back to the listing on the website, buried in the text, they were described as a replica of the well-known brand. Mm. So there are a lot of these fakes coming in via these little brown parcels. A lot of these products also don't meet European safety regulations. There have been cases of babies' pacifiers which come apart and become choking hazards,
oh, no.
Electric heaters that risk catching fire, this kind of thing.
This all sounds very bad.
It does. And look, I should point out that some of the items that you might buy from these websites are going to be perfectly adequate in quality. After all, a lot of the stuff that you buy from Amazon or from your local shopping mall, of course, a lot of that stuff was manufactured in China. But this flood of little brown paper parcels, rather than big shipments that are usually subject to customs checks, that has made it way easier for products that are dangerous or fake to make their way here because of the lack of checks. Until now, because things might be about to change. The European Commission has said it wants way stricter controls on all of these parcels. And it wants to put an end to the system of parcels under the value of 150 euros being exempt totally from customs.
Aren't the US doing something quite similar right now?
Yeah, interesting timing. So this comes just after the Trump administration tried to shut down a similar loophole. Over in the US, Chinese e-commerce companies have until now been able to deliver to the US duty-free so long as the parcel is worth less than $800. That plan in the US is actually in limbo at the time of recording. But regardless of what ends up happening over on the other side of the Atlantic, apparently the European Commission does seem to be taking its lead from the Trump administration on this. Accidentally, I'm sure. I'm sure it's just coincidental timing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this does all sound like a really good idea for the EU to bring in some checks in to make sure that customs are being paid and regulations are being met. But presumably it's going to cost quite a lot of money to actually do those checks.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you think about the mind-boggling volumes we're talking about. So just to give you an idea of how many of these little brown tax-free parcels get posted to Europe. Last year, 12 million of these parcels arrived every single day.
Oh my God. I find that so depressing.
More than 90% of them from China. So that is a lot of posts to check. I don't think anyone's suggesting that every single one of them would now be opened and examined by customs officers. It would be more about running lots of spot checks to reduce the risk of dodgy stuff getting in. Using AI to try to scan products is one idea that's been floated. But that is, of course, where ending the tax exemption for all of these little parcels comes in. Scrapping the exemption would bring in an estimated 1 billion euros in tax revenues a year.
Oh, great.
So that would be nice, yeah. And there's also been a separate suggestion from Maroš Šefčovič, who's the EU's trade commissioner, that along with making these parcels taxable, he has suggested that we should bring in an additional fee for retailers like Shein and Temu to cover the processing costs of all of these parcels being checked. It's not clear right now how exactly that would work. And I should stress that all of this stuff is at the proposal stage. Because remember, just because the European Commission says it wants something to happen, it doesn't mean it will, right? They have to get the European Parliament to agree to it. They have to get the national governments to agree to it. But I do think there is a fairly good chance of some kind of crackdown on these Chinese websites happening. As you might have noticed from the international mood, trade restrictions are kind of in vogue right now. And, you know, there are a lot of costs involved in us buying this cheap Chinese stuff en masse that we don't really think about. Like, if you buy something on Temu, it might cost you as an individual just a couple of bucks. And I really do understand that for people on low incomes, sites like that can feel like a godsend. But at the same time, the fact that these products are so insanely cheap is something that is encouraging us all to stay addicted to this horribly unsustainable business model. And we are having to deal with mountains of extra landfill waste every year because so much of this stuff breaks so quickly. And that is not a cost that you see incorporated into the listing for the, you know, 3 euro t-shirt that you might be buying from Shein. That is a cost that we're having to pay for collectively.
It really does sound to me like it might be like one of the rare things that European leaders could all agree on.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, it will also benefit European businesses if the market isn't flooded with these cheap products. It seems like a win-win to me.
I mean, I suspect if there is action on this, it won't be overnight. Even in the US, the attempt to stop these duty-free packages coming in from Temu and Shein, etc., has been reversed, at least temporarily. And things move slower here in Europe. So I think we will be working on this one for quite a while.
Will we?
Well, the Baltic disconnection from the Russian energy grid happened ahead of schedule, so maybe this can too. Europe can surprise us. But this does make for quite an interesting first item in the entree of Liu Xiaoye. He's been China's ambassador to France for the last 5 years, and he has just been appointed as China's special ambassador to the whole of Europe. He's a guy who's known for being pretty aggressively anti-Western. So I don't think he's going to be happy about this crackdown on some of China's most successful companies. And I'm going to be very interested to see how he responds to this.
We are eternally grateful for the people that keep this podcast afloat. That's you, our wonderful listeners. Thank you, everyone who donates via the website Patreon. We actually have a few new people to thank this week. Thank you to Timi, Giorgio, Michael, Kasha, Billy, Hannah, David, Dessa, Catherine, and also to Little Blue Heron for increasing.
Thank you so much, everyone. If you can't afford to support the Europeans financially, there are quite a lot of other ways that you can help us out. Specifically, leaving us a review on whatever app you're using to listen to this right now, Spotify, for example, or Apple Podcasts. Or you can also tell another person in real life who you think might like our podcast that we exist. I mean, it's amazing how many people tell us, like, wow, I've been looking for a podcast exactly like yours for ages. I wish I'd found you years ago. So that's a really simple thing that you can do that helps us to grow our audience for free. But however you choose to help us, we are very, very grateful for it.
If you can donate, then please head to patreon.com/Europeans podcast.
Are you able to see the stars in the night sky where you live when you get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and shout, good morning?
Honestly, I can't remember because I feel like we've hardly seen any sunlight for the last 4 months because the sky's been covered by clouds.
Oh.
But yeah, no, not very easily here.
Yeah, here in Paris, you can see quite a lot of satellites twinkling majestically overhead. But I only realized quite how bad the light pollution was here in Paris a couple of weeks ago when my husband told me really excitedly one morning that he got up in the night to, I don't know, to have a glass of water or something. And he had stopped in his tracks because in the darkness of the kitchen, he could actually see stars in the sky over Paris.
Wow.
And it just felt so surreal to be able to enjoy this thing, this part of the natural world that we get so detached from when we live in cities and towns. And I found it quite disturbing that this had been such an unusual experience for him. Because I love looking at stars. You know, I love doing that cliche thing of looking up and being reminded how small we are and how small our planet is compared to the vastness of the universe. So I was not surprised at all to read that supposedly one of the hot travel trends of 2025 is nocturism, travel by night and enjoying visiting new places in the darkness. It's not just about getting out into nature and enjoying the night skies, although that does seem to be the obvious thing to do. It could also be night tours of cities when it's less hot and crowded. You might want to go hunting for truffles in the woods in parts of Europe. That's often something that's easier at night when it's easier for the dogs to smell the truffles because the smell wafts up through the soil more at nighttime.
Oh.
Honestly, I don't know how seriously to take these rather fluffy news reports about this apparent travel trend. Supposedly, tourism companies are reporting a rise in bookings for things like trips to see the Northern Lights in Iceland and Sweden and elsewhere. I think to some extent it's just a fun, light thing for journalists to write about at an otherwise miserable time.
Mm-hmm.
But it does also make sense as a travel trend, right? Like, over-tourism has become a massive problem across Europe. It is also hotter than it's ever been. So it does kind of make sense for people to be craving these travel experiences that are less hot and less crowded.
It does.
If I'm being honest, I have lived in urban areas for my entire life, and I never really thought that much about what I was missing, not being able to see the stars on the regular. But especially now that I'm raising a kid in a city, I am quite troubled by the fact that if we're lucky, we might be able to go somewhere this summer where my son can see stars for the first time, at which point he will be 2 years old. So that's kind of disturbing.
Can two-year-olds even see that far away?
I think his eyes are pretty good, actually. They're definitely better than mine.
Okay.
I'm half blind. But yeah, I've been thinking about this a little bit more, this idea of light pollution, to what extent it is a problem in Europe, how it affects us, and what we can do to fix it. And someone who has thought about light much more than most people is the writer Anna Levin. She was born in Wales, but has lived in Scotland for a very long time. She is the author of 2 books about the impact of artificial light on both the natural world and our own health as humans. And I don't think I've ever heard anyone talk about light in such a beautiful, spellbinding kind of way as Anna does. Dominic and I gave her a ring up in Scotland. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as we did.
Hi, Anna. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hello. Great to be here.
We're here to talk about light today. And I wanted to start by asking you, why did you become so fascinated with light and the quality of light in the first place?
Yeah, that's interesting because I worked for years as a wildlife and environmental journalist and never really thought about light. And then I actually came into the subject from a completely different perspective because I started getting ill from the new version of the Curly CFL low energy light bulbs. And I started asking questions like, what's the difference? You know, what's the difference in the stuff that comes out of them and the old incandescent light bulbs? And that led me to a whole path of physics and international legislation and what was going on in the EU at the time. And then I sort of came full circle because I started going to dark sky conferences and reading lots of papers. And I realized how much this was an issue for the natural world and for wildlife and for the marine environment. So now I've brought the two bits of my life together and writing about impact of light on the natural world, ourselves included, of course.
I mean, I don't know how hard it is to quantify this, but just how bright is the modern world compared to, I don't know, the pre-industrial one? Like, is it possible to measure that?
It is possible to measure that, but the funny thing about light is it isn't a thing. It's a very multifaceted mystery phenomena, a force of energy. So whatever you measure, you're missing something out. And that's part of the problem with legislating about light. The other problem about light is it's a human concept. You know, what we call light is a little slither of the electromagnetic spectrum that's visible to humans, but it's not the same as what's visible to birds or rattlesnakes. So what we measure is a bit of an iffy one. But what we definitely can say is that the world has got tens of hundreds of times brighter over the last century. And over the last decades, that's exacerbated. And that's just become an explosion of light, partly because of LED lighting being brighter and bluer and lighting the night a lot more. And we can also say that it's something that the world has never seen before. We've had climates changing, we've had continents shifting, we've had volcanoes and things. But light, you know, dawn, day, dusk, night has been this steady pattern for the whole of evolution. So it's what they call novel in scientific terms. It's something that life on Earth has never dealt with before.
And I guess that's one of the reasons why we refer to light as pollution as well. And for someone like me who's never spent that much time really thinking about our relationship to light, why does it make sense to talk about light in that term as a pollution? Why is the darkness something that's worth protecting?
I think people didn't really realize till we started losing darkness and vanquishing the night through a lot of the planet and way beyond the cities, because you've got sky glow that's bright all over the world, and we've got satellites now making the night sky brighter, even, you know, far from where there's human habitation. And what we've now finding, you know, what we've lost is that light is time in the natural world. And the natural world includes the cells in our bodies and our nervous system and our immune system and our endocrine system. And when we talk about body clocks, you think we're talking about going to sleep and waking up, but it's way, way more than that. It sets every physiological process in the body, from bowel movements to blood sugar to cell renewal. So it's got huge implications for things like cancer and diabetes. It affects everything, because every cell has a body clock in a fruit fly or a human. And what we're now starting to realize is that by changing light, it's not just about having too much light at night, but also the wrong type of light, because the quality of light has changed as well as the quantity. We're messing with time in our cells, in our bodies, in the interaction between bird migration and plant pollination, and all the systems that go on in the world and within us are getting messed up. And at a time of climate change, when they're already messed up by the seasons, that is exacerbating the disruption, to the extent that ecologists are saying light pollution and the loss of the night is as significant as climate change in the disruption of the natural world. But we don't hear nearly as much about it.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, have we got better at recognizing the impact of light pollution in recent years? Is it something that governments, people, authorities are actively managing to some extent to fight and to limit?
It depends who the we is. I think Britain's quite behind. There's a lot of countries in Europe doing much better with light pollution. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot of interest in bringing in regulations at a European level. We've got an all-party parliamentary group in dark skies in Britain. But I think in the general public and the politicians, it's building. It's coming, but it's still not recognised. And you need those sort of sea changes, like we've had a lot with plastics, and you know, you have an Attenborough programme and the problem of plastic pollution in the ocean, and suddenly it becomes less acceptable just to be having single-use plastic forks and chucking your water bottle. And we need that sort of sea change in lighting. You know, on a very domestic, personal level, of people just shutting the curtains and putting the lights off and not polluting your garden by, you know, having the lights spilling out or having outdoor lights. But I get a distorted picture because I'm very, you know, I'm writing about it, I'm going to conferences and I'm in a dark sky scene. And then I, you know, go on the school run or I meet people and they've no idea what the dark sky. They think it's something from Star Wars or something. You know, no idea that that's a thing. But it's growing. And I think that's cause for hope. And it's growing in all sorts of levels, in human health, in ecology. There's been masses of scientific papers come out in the last few years. And I think there's always a time lag between the science goes ahead and then it filters into policy and public awareness later along. So I think we're in that wave.
So closing curtains is one thing that we can do as individuals as the sun sets. But what are some of the other things that local authorities or governments are doing? What are some of the exciting projects and initiatives that are coming up?
I mean, I think something to celebrate is the rise of the dark sky movement, which is designated dark sky places, which can be an island or, which is basically like in the ocean, you've got marine reserves where you're protecting that area. It's all controlled by Dark Sky International, based in Arizona, but it's a global movement. And it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the darkest place, but what it means is there's a human commitment to preserving the darkness. So it's not about having no light, it's about having appropriate light and the least disturbing light to life on Earth, to the nocturnal environment, and to humans sleeping in nearby.
And supposedly, some of these dark sky certified spots might be about to see an influx of tourists because apparently nighttime tourism is going to be the next big craze of travel in 2025. Where do you think that craving for darkness is coming from?
I think that's a good place to read you a wee bit from my initial book, Incandescent, We Need to Talk About Light.
Yes, please.
I'll just go for it and let it speak for itself. I sense two forces, both surging, growing, building momentum at astonishing speed and picking up power throughout the world. One is a great wave, garish and roaring, thundering across the planet at a thrill-seeking pace. It's sparkling and dazzling, excited and chattering, calling in a shrill voice, brighter, newer, more, more, more. It grows and glows. You can watch its conquest from space. See the world fill up with smudges and stains and pinpricks of light as it spreads its shrieking brightness, vanquishing darkness all over the planet. It's driven by a voracious, insatiable monster called profit, which harnesses technology, legislation, and fervent belief as it pushes ever onward, surging ahead with its delirium of newness, obliterating opposition with its sheer weight, pounding anything old, anything gone before. This wave seems unstoppable. It's reaching tsunami proportions, heedless to the devastation of all that lies in its path. And it would crush me too, if it wasn't for another force that's also growing stronger and is keeping me afloat, sustaining me. Broader and quieter, but no less powerful, a deep current is tugging just below the surface. It's swirling around the world, linking continents, carrying nutrients, surging ever onwards. It is stirring something ancient, reaching down to an ache from the dawn of time and carrying it forward, a longing for a purer, simpler way. It pulls and pulls, away from the shrill machinery of new, towards simplicity and authenticity. It speaks of things that are real, natural. Earth, air, soil, fire, sky. Things that have always been. Conversations by candlelight, digging a potato from the earth, the sensation of wind in hair. It craves real food, real light, real darkness, the movement of the moon and the enchantment of the stars. It seeks the night sky, rich and deep and mysterious, to be enclosed by it and opened by it, to connection with others, with the world, and with something bigger beyond us all.
Beautiful.
Beautiful.
Thank you. But that's the sense they had when I was, you know, researching Incandescent, and that's just you know, the spread and the growth of light and in dark sky circles. And there's a lot of talk about ALAN at the moment, the acronym Artificial Light at Night. And I imagine this guy, ALAN, you know, stomping over the world, and he's he's really loud and garish. And
ALAN
is out of hand. ALAN has gone wrong. You know, he's the sort of Frankenstein that we've created and, you know, loved, and he's just taken over and gone mad. Yet at the same time, there's this growing seeking for, I link it to the whale swimming craze as well, of people coming out of the water and they say they feel alive. And there's something about the way we live in a modern world that can dull something of the aliveness. And sometimes you forget what you're missing. You know, a lot of people growing up in cities don't even know that they're missing the stars. People are growing up not even having experienced a pristine night sky, when you feel that you could just pick the stars out of the sky and the Milky Way is just a shining band. And people don't even know that. But somewhere in them, there is a craving for that. And I think that darkness and the night sky is a huge part of our human experience. When people have an opportunity to experience that, they link it to a place. So in tourism terms, you know, if you can go somewhere and see that, you think, oh, that's the sky above the Isle of Rum, or that's the sky above the Cairngorms. And of course, it's the same sky, but this ALAN's in the way everywhere else. So it's places that you can get ALAN out the way have now become a really attractive place to go to.
Yeah, and with that in mind, maybe it's an inappropriate question to jump onto the tourism train here, but where are your favourite places in the world where you're able to avoid ALAN?
Get away from ALAN. Well, I'm lucky to live in Scotland, and even though there's a dire lack of awareness on a council and a government level here, you know, due to the small population and the big wild space, there are some really wonderful places that you can go. So I love heading north, going up to Pitlochry and up to the Cairngorms. I love the islands. I lived for a while on the Isle of Mull, and just starry nights were part of life there, as they once were for everybody once upon a time. I'll add in the Isle of Col in the Inner Hebrides. I've had some of the most amazing moonlight and starlight that I've ever experienced, sort of walking around at night there. And again, I think of it as being in a place, but that sky is everywhere, and that's, you know, what more of us should and could have.
Since we did that interview, I've been like diligently closing my curtains as soon as it gets dark outside. I'd never thought about that, about the idea that the light from my house was having an impact. I'd only really thought about street lights, but
yeah,
of course.
And it doesn't cost you anything to close the curtains because you can't see anything anyway.
No, it's true. And it's cozy.
Doesn't it go against Dutch culture, though? You guys love having windows open to...
Yeah, I mean, that's what people say. And actually, if you walk around the main canals in the centre of Amsterdam, you do often just see people keeping their curtains open and not giving a damn.
Walking around naked.
Don't often see that. But I'm fine with a bit of privacy as well.
And it's good for avoiding light pollution. There you go. If you are looking for somewhere particularly dark to visit in Europe where you can enjoy the night sky, you'll be pleased to hear that there are about 50 certified dark sky places in Europe, stretching from Ireland to Croatia. I'll stick the map in the show notes. I think it's really lovely that this is a form of tourism that's taking off, but I do also hope we can do it in a way that doesn't turn these beautiful dark places into yet another over-tourism nightmare. That would kind of defy the point of it, wouldn't it?
It would. The thing I like about it is I get the feeling that maybe if we spread the people out over night and day, then there'll just be fewer people around. But although I think these people that are doing night tourism, like, obviously have to go somewhere during the day as well. Or do you think they sleep?
They just kind of sleep, yeah.
Is the idea that you sleep during the day?
I mean, you've got to sleep at some point, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
People who've done nocturism, write in and tell us. Anna is the author of two beautiful books, Celebrating Darkness and Interrogating the Impact of Artificial Light on the World That We Live In. They are called Incandescent and Dark Skies. And you can find out all about them on the link to her website, which is in the show notes. Time to head to the Inspiration Station. Dominic, you've been very busy this week, but have you had time to enjoy anything when you haven't been singing or getting up randomly in the middle of the night?
Honestly, no. But a few weeks ago, I did watch a nice TV series I wanted to talk about because there's like a total plethora of spy shows on the TV at the moment. I don't know if you'd noticed.
Yes, I am here for it. We're just finishing The Recruit, which is a real guilty pleasure. It's bad, but really fun.
Yeah, that's next on my list. Good to hear it's really bad. There's also a plethora of think pieces about why are there so many spy shows around at the moment. And yeah, I think the conclusion is that there's something about this time of uncertainty and distrust that makes people want to watch spy thrillers.
That's not why I'm watching them. I'm watching them because I'm brain dead and it's fun.
Or because you want to be brain dead.
Maybe.
Anyway, one of the shows I watched and enjoyed is a remake of the Frederick Forsyth novel, The Day of the Jackal.
No, but I've seen it advertised.
It's a British-made TV show, but aside from being a really gripping spy thriller, it's kind of a European travelogue. It takes you to Munich, Belfast, Paris, Tallinn, Budapest, Cadiz, and Cyprus. The location scouts clearly had a blast making this series. And it feels like quite a timely series because it touches on the rise of the far right in Germany, the rise of an incredibly powerful tech billionaire as well. And yeah, I would highly recommend it. I found it really enjoyable, even though the assassin at the heart of the show, the Jackal, is played, in my opinion, rather unsatisfactorily by Eddie Redmayne.
Oh.
I just don't think he's a very good actor.
His face is kind of off-putting. No, it's a mean thing to say, isn't it?
That is mean, yes.
Sorry, Eddie.
I'm going to leave it with a criticism of his acting technique. but I still loved it. It's available on Sky Showtime, I think, in most of Europe, or Sky Atlantic if in the UK, or Peacock in the US.
I don't have that, but I am going to try and watch it at some point because I love a spy show.
What have you been enjoying other than The Recruit?
I've got a fun musical recommendation for you this week. Do you know what radio is?
No, I don't.
I never know how to pronounce the name of this amazing website. Maybe you're just supposed to say radio. I don't know. Anyway, it is the word radio with five O's on the end, .com. And I've been dipping into this amazing French website for years now. It is so cool. It is basically a musical time machine where you can click on any country in the world and then pick a decade, and it will play you music from that country and decade. So you can choose like DR Congo in the 1960s, Syria in the 1980s. And every time I go on this website, it throws up something amazing. I love it. Anyway, Radio have just released their first ever podcast. It is called Italia Express. And it's a musical journey through post-war Italy with five different stops: Naples, Rome, Bologna, Milan, and Genoa. Each of them is a podcast episode interweaving great music with snippets of history from that place. And you can also listen to the whole series with an Italian voiceover or a French voiceover instead of English, if you prefer, which is very cool. And as always with radio, they've just picked really cool pieces of music from like the 1950s onwards that you probably haven't heard before. You do have to listen via the website and sign up for a free trial to do that, but it is absolutely worth it. It's also one of those free trials where you don't have to put in your credit details or anything. You just set up an account and you're in for the week. But who knows? You might end up having such a nice time that you end up wanting to spend more time on this website.
I'm just looking at it now. It looks amazing.
It's so good. It is called Radio and the name of the podcast is Italia Express.
For this week's happy ending, I'm taking you to the Czech Republic, specifically to the Brdy Protected Landscape Area in central Bohemia, where local administrators had been trying to raise the funds and get permits to build a dam in the Klabava River because water was draining out of some ecologically important wetland areas. The humans had done their best to come up with a complicated design to stop the wetland areas from drying out, and the project was expected to cost over 30 million Czech crowns, which is around 1 million euros. Mm. So this was all happening, years and years of preparatory work, and then a few weeks ago, some local conservationists went to the site and saw that the problem had been fixed.
Eh?
All of the money and the permits were no longer necessary, because a colony of beavers had stepped in, and over the course of a few nights, just a few nights, they had built multiple dams that fixed the problem.
Yes, go beavers!
Isn't that incredible?
That's so cool.
They chose exactly the right place that the humans wanted it to be, which apparently is often the case. They often choose areas that would be useful for the ecology. And this family of eight who live in the area are thought to be the beavers that did it, although they could have been helped by some extra beavers that the conservationists don't know about. And the dams mean that some rare stone crayfish, some frogs and some other species that live in the wetlands will be able to keep their homes and stay happy.
Love the story. Great job, beavers.
Yeah, thank you, beavers. We really don't deserve you.
Next week, we're talking about your favourite thing in the world, Dominic. Television.
Yay.
Specifically, we've got a very fun interview about TV formats and why so many of us watching TV in different countries end up watching local versions of the same TV shows. How does that business work? I had a very fun conversation with probably the world's leading expert on TV formats. So you have that to look forward to next week.
I can't wait.
In the meantime, you can find us on Blue Sky, Mastodon and Instagram. Just type in Europeans Podcast. You should be able to find us.
This week's episode was produced by Morgan Childs and Wojciech Oleksiak. We'll be back next week on Thursday in your feeds. Tell all your friends about us. Shout it from the hilltops.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.